Before we get going with this episode, check out what's going on over at Patreon. Here's a preview of our Little Alarms series, only available on Patreon. Do you think there are people...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, because I've heard people say, I didn't know about Travis Kelce until he started dating Taylor Swift. But do you think people are like, huh, I didn't know about Taylor Swift until he started dating Travis.
Yes.
She started dating Travis Kelce. I don't
smaller.
Think so.
I think I it's a smaller. So. No, I guarantee you there are some sports fans out there who have followed Travis Kelce's career for whatever, how long he's been around.
And, no.
like, and are just come finding on. Out about Taylor Swift. Impossible.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now on to our episode. Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this very special doubleheader Aftermath episode. First up, we're speaking with guest expert Dr. Josiah Osgood. Dr. Osgood is a professor of classics at Georgetown University and a historian of Rome who researches the fall of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. His latest book is entitled Uncommon Wrath: How Caesar and Cato's Deadly Rivalry Destroyed the Roman Republic. Let's hear what he has to say about the assassination of Julius Caesar. And stay tuned, because right after, we'll be speaking to an expert about the cancellation of Armie Hammer. Hi, Josiah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I was hoping you could start off by giving us a brief description of the state of the Roman Republic around the time that Julius Caesar's born, 100 BCE. Can you set the stage for us?
Yes. So Rome was a huge city, the biggest of its day, population into the hundreds of thousands, and a city of incredible contrast. There were senators who lived in mansions that were designed by the best Greek architects. And then you had tenements where most Romans would live that were fire traps. So you had the city of Rome, this amazing place. But then, of course, by now, Rome also had acquired an empire overseas. So Sicily, Spain, North Africa, soon Gaul would be part of the Roman Empire and what is France, and then also out to the east. So it's a city state, really, that had been around for hundreds of years, but it's now struggling with some of the opportunities, but also the challenges that all this wealth of empire presented.
And what kind of family was Caesar born into? What was his childhood and young adulthood like?
Yeah, so Julius Caesar was a noble, which meant in the Roman Republic, so everyone had to be elected to office. It was a republic. But there were also families that were called the nobles. And that meant that somebody in the past had actually held political office. And on top of that, Caesar had a further distinction. He was a patrician. And patricians were those who claimed that their families went back to the start of the Republic. So that was incredibly prestigious. The Romans loved history. They revered the past, their own glorious past. So Caesar could sort of use that as a calling card in his political career, the fact that he was from one of these patrician families. Now, this kind of set him up in a sense. But it also maybe was a bit of a burden in some ways too, because it meant from childhood on, you know, he really was expected to live up to these ancestors. So it kind of gives you an advantage in Rome to be from one of these families, but it also creates this incredible set of expectations that you're gonna have to fight in the army, win wars, be elected to office. So it's an aristocratic background, but in a system where you are gonna have to compete in all your elections to get ahead in public life.
And what is his political career at first like? And how does he become such a threat soon? After?
Yeah, so his family, the Julian family, they were patrician, but actually they really hadn't done a lot for much of Roman history. So in the great days of imperial expansion, there's really nothing to be heard of the Julian family. So a generation or two before Caesar, they finally were sort of starting to re-enter the political scene in a big way. So Caesar is kind of trying to capitalize on that momentum. He wants to take himself and his family even further. The challenge that he faced, though, was that he came of age at a time of civil war, a really vicious civil war, actually, but sort of started as a quarrel between the politicians of Rome, but came to engulf thousands and thousands of soldiers, ordinary Romans fighting in the legions. So there were two sides, obviously, in this civil war, and Caesar essentially threw a connection on his aunt's side was on the losing side in this civil war. And as a teenager, he kind of went into hiding for a period. He was so scared about what would happen to him. So after that, he's going to get involved in politics when he comes of age. But he has this problem that, you know, his family has sort of been on the wrong side. And he has a fear, I think, throughout the rest of his career of what people opposed to him might do. That really goes back to that scary period he had in the Civil War.
Once he's back, how does his career shift? What kinds of political roles does he take on?
Yeah. So there's a ladder of offices in Rome, and you have to climb the ladder, or at least most people do. There are occasional exceptions, but Caesar climbed the ladder in the regular way. So you start as what is called a quaestor, and that's a financial officer. These folks are often sent to provinces overseas. So Caesar was sent to Spain, to one of the Roman provinces in Spain. And there's a story told, right, about Caesar by his ancient biographers, that he saw a statue of Alexander the Great when he was off in Spain. And he sort of looked at it, sighed, you know, practically burst into tears, right? Thinking that Alexander had conquered the world by the age of 30 or so. And there was Caesar doing kind of dull financial tasks for the Roman government in Spain. Now, this story may sort of be invented a little bit later or hyped up a little bit later, but it definitely reveals something about Caesar, which was that he had extraordinary ambition. So he was working his way up the ladder, but he really pretty clearly from an early age wanted to become the top dog or the first man in Rome, to put it a little bit more grandly. So he would need to fight in wars ultimately to do that, but also to win kind of in the game of politics back in the city of Rome.
So is he eventually appointed to the Senate? And once he is, what kind of a leader is he? How popular is he, not just amongst the senators, but also within the public?
Yeah. So the Romans have a Senate. And of course, this actually is the direct inspiration for the United States Senate. So we can kind of understand this system pretty well. The Roman Senate is made up of those who have held office, high political office, or are currently in office. So you kind of enter it for life. So Caesar entered the Senate, and once he held his first political office. And there's sort of a divide between politicians in this period. There are some who sort of want the Senate to be in charge, to kind of manage the empire, to assign military commands, to set the budget for the Roman Republic. But then you also have a breed of popular politicians who like to go to the other part of the Roman government, which is the people's assemblies. And they will present laws to the assemblies about running the empire, or perhaps giving land to ordinary citizens. So Caesar very much goes on this second path. He is a popular politician, and he really clearly formed a bond with the people of Rome, especially those who could be in the city and see him. He was quite charismatic. He had a bright eyes, we're told by his ancient biographer, a good smile. He was an excellent public speaker. So all of these traits he was able to sort of turn into a career as essentially, we would say nowadays, basically a sort of populist or a popular politician. And this made people in the Senate, who wanted the Senate in charge of things, nervous.
Can you tell us more about the triumvirate that is set up, and why was this beneficial for Caesar, and what were its challenges?
Yeah, so Caesar was rising the ladder, and people were worried about him, but he was still a somewhat ordinary Roman politician by and large, and he went off to Spain a second time and won a military victory. So he came back to Rome, and he should have been entitled to celebrate a big parade known as a triumph. But one of his foes, a guy named Cato the Younger, sort of figured out a way to block Caesar, because Caesar wanted to run for the top office of consul. So what happened was there were other powerful politicians who were also being stopped by Cato in the Senate from getting things they wanted. One was a guy named Pompey, a great general, and another was a guy named Crassus. So the three men form what we in modern times have called the triumvirate, the board of three, or pact of three, we should say here. And their goal is to try to sort of make sure they get what they need out of the Roman government and fight this senatorial faction that is blocking them. So it was a very, very important alliance once it was revealed. You have three very powerful politicians coming together to get the things that they want. And this is how, for example, Julius Caesar will get his command in Gaul for 5 years, ultimately 10 years, in which he waged an incredible war of conquest.
And did he have I mean, were he and Pompey and Crassus, were they friends? Because it seemed like they had a lot of beef. What was the root of it all?
Yeah, such a good question. So this is part of why the alliance kind of took everyone in Rome by surprise, because especially Pompey and Crassus, they were both a little bit, especially Crassus, a little bit older. They were sort of former enemies. So Caesar's masterstroke, in a way, was to bring those two together. Now, Crassus was a millionaire. He was kind of interested in using money in politics to kind of buy younger politicians. He had helped Caesar out before. And then Caesar and Pompey had kind of been working together. So Caesar is basically the one who's going to hold the three together in this alliance. And part of how he did it also, right, was Caesar ended up marrying his daughter, Julia, his only child. He loved her very much. He married her to Pompey. And this proved actually to be, so far as we can tell, quite a happy marriage. But it definitely was a way that Caesar could sort of, especially when he was away from Rome, kind of make sure that he kept Pompey on his side.
I we're also curious if we could get some backstory on who Brutus was. What is his role in the Senate? What's his relationship to Caesar? Do they have beef?
Yeah. So Brutus, they do ultimately have a beef, that's for sure. We will get there. So Brutus is the son, actually, of Caesar's lover, not his wife, but his lover for many years, a patrician, a woman named Servilia. And her husband was named Brutus. That's why the son is called Brutus, Marcus Brutus. And he was sort of a young noble trying to work his way up the ladder, just like everybody else. Not quite young enough to be Caesar's son, though there was sort of later a kind of false story that he actually was the son of Caesar. That almost certainly is wrong, but he was younger. And he very much kind of belonged to that group that wanted the Senate in charge of things, and that was sort of worried about the power of one man becoming too great. Brutus, like all other nobles, had quite a strong sense of himself and his own importance. One thing we happen to learn casually from the letters of Cicero went off to be the governor of a territory in the Roman East, and he quite to his shock, discovered that young Brutus had actually loaned out money to provincials at the rate of 48% per year. This was totally extortionate. and Brutus had even kind of masked this and using middlemen, and had gotten a decree of the Senate to actually allow this loan to go through because it sort of violated some laws. So we shouldn't judge him purely by this one action. He was really willing to make some sacrifices for his beliefs, and I respect that about Brutus, but he definitely had a strong sense of entitlement.
Now, how does the triumvirate fall apart? And what does this mean for Caesar?
Yeah, so you have the alliance of Caesar, Pompey, Crassus, and then there are enemies who tend to be champions of the Senate. So what happened was that Crassus went off to the east to fight a big war in what is modern Iraq, kind of hoping for his own great glory and more wealth. And he got massacred along with his son. Terrible defeat for Rome. Three legions were lost. So bye-bye Crassus. And then Pompey and Caesar, they were working together, but Julia died from complications of childbirth, and her child died as well. This was very sad for Pompey and a great blow for Caesar. You know, we know Caesar he was praised for sort of keeping a stiff upper lip, which sort of shows us about Roman values, but also shows us that he was very shaken by the loss of his daughter. If you ever watch the HBO Rome miniseries, yes, it was quite good. It starts with this scene, and it portrays it very well, in my opinion. Yeah. All right. So the three of them kind of break up for the reasons I've just said. And Pompey and Caesar don't part ways immediately after Julia's death, but the senators who dislike Caesar sort of start to try to isolate him politically, and they end up peeling Pompey over to their side. So this is not so much Brutus yet, who's still a little bit younger, but Brutus's uncle, who we mentioned before, Cato the Younger, and some of Cato's friends.
And can you, I feel like, actually, I want to ask this question first. How does Caesar's relationship with Cleopatra cause political controversy for him? Was that a good look for him?
Yeah. So this is part of why Caesar is so legendary today, is you know, he's good at everything, a general and a writer and a lover. So so he and his enemies end up fighting a civil war. And Pompey went off to Egypt. Caesar followed him. The Egyptians killed Pompey. They sort of were worried about picking the wrong side in the civil war. Caesar showed up in Alexandria, the great Egyptian city, and it turns out Egypt was having its own civil war too. And between the king, who was a teenager, and his slightly older sister, Cleopatra, and Caesar ended up backing Cleopatra, and they had this great love affair. There's really no doubt about that. And this kind of upset people in Rome, even at the time of the war, because what's Caesar doing in Egypt? What's he spending all his time there for? People started talking. But then things got really bad when Caesar came back to Rome, the winter in civil war, and Cleopatra came later to join him. And she stayed at one of his estates, kind of a sort of luxury villa that he had on the outskirts of the city. And of course, they'd had a child together. So, you know, all sorts of gossip started. There's lots of xenophobia here, certainly. People in Rome just really didn't like this woman, Cleopatra. So that added to Caesar's political problems.
And can you help us explain, I want to backtrack a tiny bit, can you explain to us the dictator for life title that Caesar managed to attain? How did he do this, and how did this threaten the Republic?
Yeah. So Rome had the office of dictator. And of course, we know that word in English. In Rome, it hadn't always been a bad word. It was an office that you used during emergencies. So if there was a war, you could have a dictator who would have supreme command during the war. So Caesar started out during the Civil War as a dictator like that. But what happened was eventually by the Senate and then a vote of the people. Now, how authentic this was, we don't really know. But he was made dictator for life. Okay. And that really was upsetting because the dictator traditionally had been an emergency position, right? You should only have it for a little while just to see the state through the crisis. And when you have the dictatorship for life, right, that, you know, is upsetting to those wedded to Roman tradition. It implied that Caesar was never going to give up power. And on top of that, he had plans to go fight a big war in the East. So he would be holding the supreme power, and he would be leaving his minions behind in Rome to run everything. So this was just intolerable for traditional Roman senators and for Marcus Brutus.
Okay, so now that we're here, can you walk us through the events leading up to Caesar's assassination? How were his friends acting or quote unquote friends acting towards him? And why didn't he beware the Ides of March?
Yeah. All right. So this was a big conspiracy. And in hindsight, it was sort of amazing that the conspirators managed to keep it all secret, their plans. So there might have been 20, even more than that, men in on this plot. They were politicians for the most part. And I think what's most important to remember is that some of these were men where people Caesar had fought in the Civil War. He had given them pardons. That included Brutus, actually Marcus Brutus. But some of them were also his old friends and officers going back for many, many, many years. So even they turned, some of them anyway, on Caesar as well. So this shows us there was a lot of unhappiness for various reasons, right? Caesar had wrecked the Republic. Maybe he wasn't promoting people, some felt, to the extent that their talents deserved. So they start talking and they kind of have secret meetings, right? It had to be handled delicately. We're told that one way Brutus tested the waters would be he would talk about philosophy. He loved philosophy. So he would say, how do you feel about killing a tyrant? And this would be a way to sort of start to figure out if people would get involved in the conspiracy. So they form a plan eventually that they will come to the Senate on the Ides of March, March 15th, in the Roman calendar. And Caesar will be there. They'll be having a meeting. And he wouldn't have a huge bodyguard in the Senate. And they would smuggle in daggers. This was the plan, hidden beneath their togas. And they would all, on a prearranged signal, go up to Caesar, encircle him, and stab him. So that is the plan for the Ides of March itself.
And then how does it all go down? Because from what we've read, Caesar was actually hesitant about showing up that day. How do they enact their plan?
Yeah. So, right, did Caesar, the great joyous Caesar, who's won all these battles, survive through thick and thin, right? Did he not see it coming? This is the great question.
Yes.
And there are hints in some ancient sources that maybe Caesar was sort of sick of living. He had kind of won everything now. It was just no longer so much kind of fun to compete. I don't really buy this. I think he was quite arrogant. He had been all along. He was more confident than ever in many ways, in my opinion. And his plan was that he was going to go off to the East and fight this great war. He would become the true heir to Alexander the Great if he could pull off this Eastern victory and sort of defeat the successors to the Persians. So his idea is that he was going to leave just a few days after the Ides of March. And I think he just thought he was kind of tying up loose ends. But we are told that he didn't want to go to the Senate that day at the last minute, that his wife, Calpurnia, not Cleopatra, although she was in Rome at the same time, but his wife, Calpurnia, had a dream. And she begged Caesar not to go. And if you've ever read or watched Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Shakespeare makes a great scene out of this. Perhaps she really did sense something was wrong. She might have had better political antennae than Caesar at this point. So he did delay in going to the Senate meeting, but he eventually showed up. So we're told Julius Caesar had a gold chair at this time. This was something that infuriated traditional senators. The gold chair was set out at the Senate house for him to sit in. Then it was removed, so maybe Caesar wasn't coming. The conspirators were panicking. Maybe their plan wasn't going to work. But then in the end, Caesar did come, and they were able to carry out their plan. One of them presented a petition to Julius Caesar, handed it to him, and Caesar started to look at it, or sort of actually complained a little bit, we're told, about having to look at it. And then the conspirators gathered around him, they formed a circle, pulled out their daggers, and proceeded to hack at Julius Caesar. Almost everybody else in the Senate, we are told, fled at this point in a panic. And after the deed, Cicero, the famous public speaker, tells us that Brutus, Marcus Brutus, lifted his dagger aloft, the bloody dagger, and cried out the name of Cicero, and then yelled that freedom had been restored.
Wow. Now, what happens in the immediate aftermath of his assassination?
So Caesar's body was lying dead on the floor of the Senate, stabbed, we are told, 23 times. And the assassins, most of the senators have fled in a panic. And the assassins lift their daggers high, and they start to parade through the city of Rome, crying out that they have restored freedom. But the reaction in Rome is probably not what they expect. People were panicked, and everyone went into hiding. All the shops in the city immediately shut, and the assassins ended up running to the Capitoline Hill, where there was a temple that sort of was kind of a place where they could find sanctuary and regroup and figure out what they were going to do next.
What do you attribute to the recent obsession, particularly from men, with the fall of the Roman Empire?
Yeah. So, yeah, how often do you think about Rome? That was the meme, right? And turns out some guys are thinking every day about it. Well, guilty is charged in my case. So why?
Well, you have a better excuse.
Professional interest, purely.
Yeah.
Yes. So why do people think about Rome and fantasize even about Rome is the question. So, you know, I think some of it is definitely it's kind of a very exciting, very visceral culture. Gladiators and soldiers and military campaigns. This is kind of the stuff of movies or video games nowadays. And it's definitely fun to read about it or to watch TV shows about it, to think about it. So I think that's definitely a big part of it. I think also at our current political moment, right, in the United States, we're in living in a republic, but as we know, recent years have been turbulent. I think this period of Roman history in some ways seems perhaps more relevant than ever to us. So that's another source of the fascination. And the personalities are just so big too, and kind of leap off the page for Caesar, and we mentioned Cleopatra, and Crassus, the millionaire, and Cato, the unbending opponent of Caesar. All of these are kind of names in pop culture.
Yeah. So we ask all of our guest experts this question. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the assassination of Julius Caesar, who or what would that be?
Yeah, so I would say Caesar's arrogance, and really arrogance would be the concept I would go for. Caesar didn't have to be killed at all. If he'd kept a proper bodyguard, right, and taken precautions, he could have gone off to the east and fought the war that he wanted to. Now, if you're kind of cheering for the assassins here, right, you know, you could sort of say too more broadly, right, that his arrogance, right, his disrespect for tradition ended up creating all the hostility to him as well, and the way he trampled freedom. Now, I think it's important at the same time to sort of recognize they didn't have all the right in this controversy. And Caesar had done a lot for the Roman people and did have a concern for the ordinary Roman out on the street. So there's definitely a clash there, but I think if I had to say one thing, as you asked, I would go sort of for the idea that it was his arrogance more than anything that really got him killed. He failed to respect what his enemies believed and what they were capable of.
Wow. Josiah, thank you so much for helping us and walking us through this incredible topic. And we're going to now go on to Patreon and discuss this further.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And now we're speaking with guest expert, Dr. Gloria Brame. Dr. Brame is the author of Different Loving and Different Loving 2 Come Hither and The Truth About Sex, a sex primer for the 21st century. She has a PhD in human sexuality and is renowned for her pioneering work in removing the stigma from BDSM and fetish sex. Let's hear what she has to say about the cancellation of Armie Hammer. Hi, Gloria. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Rebecca. Quite the honor.
Oh, my goodness. The honor is ours. And I was wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit about you and your focus of research and your focus of work and how you got involved.
At some point in my very straight career, I realized I was very kinky. And I started reading a lot about kink. And I was very frustrated because there wasn't a whole lot at the time. This was a very long time ago, Rebecca. You were probably a twinkle in your parents' eye at the time. And there was very little material. I was an academic and nothing satisfied the academic in me. So I ended up starting a support group, had a couple of years doing that. And then I wrote what turned out to be a groundbreaking book on kink because it took it completely out of the realm of you're nuts. It's pathological. You're going to be a criminal. You're a crazy person. You know, and just demonstrated through voluminous research and hundreds of interviews with people actually doing these things that It's always been around. Plenty of normal people, many great artists and writers were kinky. And here are these kinky people and their truck drivers and teachers and doctors and lawyers, and everything is fine. They're just weird in the bedroom, you know.
Well, this is a perfect transition for my next question, which is how has how we talk about sex and the culture around sex changed in the last century?
Oh, it's, well, the interesting thing is, I would say that if you weren't getting your information directly from a church, you probably weren't getting any information, and there were always going to be people who were non-conventional when it came to sex. There's always been gay people. There always have been transgendered people. The question is, did they know themselves, and did they function in a society where they were permitted to be themselves? And you can see the arc of human history pretty much, you know, what they believed 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. Like, they wouldn't punish certain even kinky things as crimes. You know, that whole legal system of even arresting and punishing gay men was very much of a late 18th, 19th century thing. The first laws, I believe, really came in the 1880s when a lot of people were doing sex research. So, for example, it always depends on who's framing it and where they are. The Scandinavian countries are far ahead of America. They have completely depathologized all sexual nonconformity, for example, out there, right? So in this country, depending on who you see, you might hear anything. If you go to somebody like me whose research is based on the science, you're going to hear the truth or the reality. But if you go to somebody who was trained as a Christian counselor, for example, you're not going to hear anything positive
about
probably
sex. Yeah.
About all the things that, you know, people today accept as normal, from anal. I mean, that was not even a discussion when I was growing up. That was thought to be something only gay people did, gay men did, you know.
Wow.
And we didn't even want to think about that. You know, when I was growing up, oral sex was totally off the table, at least at a public level. People were still doing it. Boys were still asking for it. But, you know, it was really considered perverted.
So, yeah. So it's come a long way.
Yeah. It's one of the nice things about getting old is, like, it's a whole new world, you know, and I have to explain that to my clients who are even older than me and want to date. I'm like, oh my God, you know?
Well, we came up with a phrase on the show. It's not even a real word, but
yeah,
we call it American prudism. And it's a term that we use when we're talking about America's obsession with censoring sex and women's bodies. Can you help shed some light on this concept? Are Americans prude? And if so, why?
I don't think that humans are humans, no matter where you go. There's BDSM in China and Nigeria and in Turkey and everywhere you go in the world, certainly in Japan, lots of Japan. You know, I mean, these are common human desires that run through all of us because we all have linked DNA, and DNA traits show up all over the world.
Mm.
Right? So you can assume gay people everywhere, transgender people everywhere, kinky people everywhere. But America has had a history of allowing right-wing voices, or rather religious ideological voices, to have a kind of death grip on politics.
Oh, I see.
So I believe that, you know, a lot of people think I'm a crazy sinner going to hell. And I like to tell them I'm Jewish. We don't even believe in hell. So that puts the, that shuts them up pretty quickly. But no, I mean, there are still millions of Americans who believe the same thing that people believed 100 years ago. Mm. That everything that, and that's not really, I can't just blame, you know, the Protestant preachers here who have done what they've done. You know, it's really Judeo-Christian culture, because it was the same in Europe. So why is Europe moving ahead? Europe seems to accept science. Wow. And America has a lot of science deniers. So when you want to talk about the science of sex, some people think I'm wacky. And I have to explain, this is why my first book turned me into a sexologist. I ask myself the question, who established what is normal sex? And who established it were people like Freud, you know, who believed that women were naturally inferior and biologically didn't have orgasms, that was a little unnatural. And, you know, how can you please women in bed? You know, it's impossible. And the penis is the only real organ that matters, because the man is closer to God. And, you know, and Freud was Jewish. So, I mean, you have to assume they were really entrenched in what one might politely call patriarchal Victorianism, interchangeable. and we're the children of that culture.
Yes.
Also. So England has also had problems. But again, they exist within the European Union, you know, and they do seem to have more faith in science, but maybe not the plenty of anti-vaxxers in the UK as well.
Now, could you help us could you tell us what is BDSM and how long has it been around?
BDSM has never not been around. From all of the recorded archaeological records, which these were things that I did for Different Loving, is I looked back at the art, you know, of the time, and we have as much art as we can possibly find. I don't know about cave scribblings, but let's say early Rome, lots of documentation of flagellations and orgiastic art and lots of stuff going on and three ways. And the Greeks, of course, gave us gay sex. So, I mean, depictions, very explicit depictions of gay sex. So we have a load of stuff, and we probably would have had a whole lot more if anti-sex forces hadn't very nicely, handily destroyed everything that they deemed obscene throughout the Middle Ages. So, yeah. So there's very little of that art, but it's enough to tell us that people have always been doing these. And, you know, even in the Bible, there's kind of kinky stuff. There's, you know, men with several wives. There's Songs of Solomon, which celebrate sex and so forth. BDSM, rope bondage in Japan, ancient tradition. Foot binding, is that BDSM? It is if you have a fetish for it. You know? I mean, there's, you know, and everything changes. So even the form that the expression of this impulse to exchange power, to have one person perhaps be obedient by consent to somebody who was dominant. I can't imagine human history without those relationships. Sometimes they were formalized, like in an institutional setting, right? But they pervade society really all over the place, you know, the boss-worker relationship. That's why it's bad for a boss to have an affair with an employee because of the power dynamic, the whole Me Too movement, you know, the idea that men could get away with all this stuff at the workplace, you know, it's always gone on. You know, what BDSM in itself is, the current, the modern understanding, which is really only, let's say, maybe 50 years old, there's a modern understanding that none of this works without mutual consent. In other words, mutual consent is the differential between BDSM and, let's say, violence or rape or abuse of some kind. And that's really at the heart of the Armie Hammer thing.
Yes. And what are the kind of protocols and practices within the community when exploring consensual BDSM? Well, I guess you don't say consensual BDSM because it is consensual.
Right.
If it is BDSM.
Right.
Yes.
But you always kind of have to say that. But
yeah.
Yes, it's consensual. It only goes on between two people who can give consent. That's a whole other subject, which means you must be of legal age and you may not be intellectually handicapped because your thinking might be compromised, right? Or you can't have Alzheimer's because we know your cognition is deeply compromised. You see what I mean? And you can't do it with animals because they can't say bow wow yes, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't do it with corpses because they can't, you know, I mean, all of these things are built in, but we even really think about the nature of the relationship and how old the people may be and stuff like that. So what is a newcomer to BDSM learn? I think they learn that, well, they learn endless. If they go to classes or take courses online, they're going to learn the importance of consent and how big a thing it is. And they're going to learn various techniques like using a safe word. Most people know what a safe word is these days because it's drifted into mainstream culture quite a bit. But safe wording is just to be sure the person understands that you didn't miscommunicate, that they didn't take your no for a yes, yes, as men have often claimed about women, that you actually have a safe word that sounds a little weird. Some people just use red light, you know, red light, green light, or yellow. But other people are like popsicles.
Or yeah, it could be anything.
It can be anything. But that word serves, and if they're gagged, then they may have a safe signal. Like they're told to hold something, they can drop it. You know, there are a million different ways to do it, depending on the couple or group. And yeah. So that is, until someone has learned about consent and how it functions, it can be dangerous, even within the BDSM world, because the BDSM world is huge. And you don't know, you know, you could go to an event and there'll be 200 people. You don't know how many of them are just drifted in for the night to look for, to get their kicks, or they're actually a predator and they're not really well known. So, you know, the only person that can really safeguard their own security and their own body autonomy is going to be the person who wants to submit. And that means having a lot of talks and a lot of negotiations and saying some of the things you like and the things you don't, and coming up with things like, here are my hard limits.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So in the Armie Hammer situation, this was different.
Yes.
And he tried to defend his actions, claiming that it was BDSM. Now, what do we know about the allegations against him, and would you consider what he did BDSM?
Well, non-consensual BDSM is not BDSM. What he did was kinky. What he did was pervy and unconventional sex. But he didn't, from the accounts of the witnesses that I read, or witness that I read, my impression was that he didn't negotiate with them. He didn't say, how would you feel about doing the scene with me where we pretend you're my slave? He actually made them feel and go through the BDSM, you know, BDSM experience, which has a lot of ups and downs to it. You know, it can be very exciting, but it's kind of, you have to think about how not everybody totally hates a rape in their body, but they all hate a rape in their head. In other words, your body is one thing, and where your mind goes, that's the psychological component of sex and very psychological component of BDSM. And it's why people, you know, who can't even prove in court that they've been abused, I believe they've been abused because they've been psychologically harmed. So I think that's what he did to the women. I am not clear on exactly what kind of physical stuff, which I gather they didn't like either, but I think he scared the living shit out of them. I think it turned into a horror show. When they had sex, they were with somebody they thought they could trust. He's so nice looking. He's so wealthy. Who would imagine a guy like that would have to force sexual activity on anyone? Why? Well, and that's the problem, because I think the turn on for people like that is making somebody else frightened and miserable. And if that's your intent, we see BDSMers, we want to have a good time. We want to show people a good time. We want to show them that they can live out their fantasies and experience human ecstasy. Because at its best, good BDSM is ecstatic. It's transcendent. It's just not like something you can just feel one day in your bedroom. You know, there has to be a lot of thought given to it. Even if you might experiment and like it, you still might not be ready. And I've seen that a lot. You know, I've seen people who are like, I don't know what it is, but I'll give it a try. And they do it, and then they're embarrassed to admit how much it screwed them up. And I'm not even talking about this kind of being somebody's girlfriend and being subjected to this time and time again. I think it's traumatizing.
Now, from what you were explaining, I mean, it sounds like enjoyable BDSM is feels very safe, which is the main difference about the experience that the victims were having, you know, and what they came out and expressed was how scared, actually.
Yes,
themselves.
And they don't feel coerced. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people have coercion fantasies, but underneath, they don't feel coerced. You know, because we know kind of what we're doing, and they know they can stop it. If they have to stop it, they can stop it pretty quickly. They get a safe word, you know?
Yeah.
And at that point, somebody will say, what's the matter, honey? Are you not feeling well? You know, and you're very human to each other. And he just sounded like he let his ego go insane. That he had no limits, you know?
He mainly engaged, from what we know, with women who had no prior experience with BDSM. Many of them didn't know what it was. Assuming if BDSM is what he was interested in, there's a community out there that he could have sought. So why didn't he do that?
See, that is the question with most sex criminals. And I was interviewed a few years ago for this guy who was carrying Swiss cheese around in Philadelphia and would drive up to girls and wave the Swiss cheese at them and say obscene things and tell them he would pay him $50 if they'd rub the Swiss cheese on him. He was known as the Swiss cheese fetishist of Philadelphia. And so the big thing is, he could have paid any hooker in the world to come over and rub him with a slice of cheese. Come on. I mean, an easy job, right? Easy $100 or whatever. You know who? He could have gone to a dominatrix. He could have taken his fetish out even to clubs to see if anybody else might possibly share it. But that's not the thrill. The thrill is feeling this kind of brute power over women. Mm. It's actually seeing them unhappy and actually seeing them scared, really scared, you know? And that's, it's very complex, but it's, I would say that BDSMers, being mainly mentally healthy people, or as much as anyone is these days, but, you know, that's not the point. The point is you come out of it feeling like, as I said, transcendent, but like you've had this unbelievable rush because you were able to be, to know you would be safe and that you would could trust that the person would never cause harm. Not that they might not cause you pain, not that they might not give you a wicked spanking. You know what I mean? Not that. But those are the things you want, right? Or a submissive, that's why you get involved with them. These girls had no expectation that they were going to a sadist. They thought he was, you know, sweet as pie, I guess. Mm-hmm. So they didn't understand that. And what he did was, I would say, preconscious BDSM. You know, there was a time long ago when there were always predators who would prey on submissive people and criminally sadistic people too out there, you know, but these days we know better. Those kind of people are usually pushed out of the scene, rejected, discussed, gossiped about, and disapproved of in general, if somebody is, you know, breaking what we consider to be our ethical core of practices. So I really felt that I didn't think they would be able to prosecute the case against him. Mm-hmm. Because it would be really hard to prove that case, you know, without like visible injuries on the body that they hadn't consented to. But in my world, he's a sex criminal and needs to get some mental help. Or he really gets off on making people scared of him and miserable, you know, which... fragile masculinity, right?
Yeah, I've heard of it. is cannibalism a fetish? I have to ask, because he seemed to be obsessed with expressing cannibalistic thoughts and mixing that with his sexual experience.
There is a cannibalism fetish community.
Okay.
It's not part of the BDSM world. But they're not, the sane ones are not eating anybody or attempting to eat anyone. They keep it in the realm of the realm of the possible, which would be pretending, you know.
It's more role playing.
Yeah.
I see.
Does he have, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know if that's a genuine fetish he had or if it's the fetish that he mimicked to scare the shit out of them.
I see. Yeah.
Because his kick was clearly frightening an right. unknowing woman and feeling power over and telling her, I'm going to own you. You're my slave. And, you know, that's really unpleasant coming out of the blue at you.
Yeah, that'll freak me out for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Gloria, how detrimental is kink shaming to us as a society? Do you think that what kind of effects do we see because of it?
Well, a lot of people still carry the notion that if you're into kinky things, something is wrong with you. You're crazy. You're wild. You're an anarchist. I like anarchy. I'm a little wild. Some have said I'm crazy. You know what I mean? But they mean it in like this kind of sick way, like they're going to go out and hurt you and hurt your children.
Yeah.
And that is horrible. It's a complete misapprehension. And it makes it very difficult sometimes and in some places for BDSM people to just have a good time. Like, you know, club events get canceled, less so now than before. Cops used to love to suddenly show up and bust a group of people, as they did and probably still do with the gay community to some extent. You know, so there is this demonizing. But we're never going to get rid of kink shaming until we get rid of sex shaming. And that is pervasive.
Yeah. So we ask all of our guest experts this same question.
Okay.
At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for, in this particular episode, the cancellation of Armie Hammer. Who or what would that be?
Wow. I would say Armie Hammer. Because if you do shitty things, they come back to you. If you treat people like shit, you know, if karma exists, he just got his karma. He was outed for being a shitty guy to his girlfriends. Okay? And he deserved that. Now, did he deserve to have all his movie contracts and career die because of that? That's a different discussion. But I feel he did it to himself by being a shitty person, and he knew he was being a shitty person. And he was so rich and so beautiful, I guess he didn't think anyone would ever do that to him. And now he knows. So I feel a kind of justice was served.
Wow. Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today and talking to us about this.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to head over to Patreon and discuss this further. So thank you so much for your time.
Okay. You're very welcome. Take care.
If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned, because next week we'll be discussing the Dust Bowl. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.